We've been living in Georgia for some years, and we take on a certain amount of the culture. Ty Cobb, of course, is a hero in Georgia. And on his 70th birthday, a local journalist interviewed him, and pretty soon they were talking about the good old days of baseball. And as they talked, Ty Cobb indicated how disappointed he was with modern baseball. And the journalist asked him, if you would be playing today, what do you think your batting average would be? And he said about 300. Now, Ty Cobb's lifetime average had been 370 or thereabouts. And the journalist asked him, what would be the most important reason for that batting average? Would it be the night games? Would it be all the travel, artificial turf, the new pitches? And Ty Cobb said the main reason would be I'm 70 years old. You're too close. Well, some things get better with age. And I think science is one of them. My hope over the next three sessions would be to talk about science, to say something about how it works with a bias toward medicine and health sciences. The principles are the same. How do we know what is actually true? Who grades it? And I hope you leave this first session feeling that science is, in fact, understandable, but it's absolutely awesome. It's worthy of everyone's attention, not just the attention of scientists. If I'm not convincing, the second session will be the same as the first session. With the second session, what I would like to do is make the case that the problems of the world are even more awesome, that there is room for discouragement, that some feel it is hopeless, and perhaps it even is. Perhaps weeping is the truth. But I hope you leave feeling that there are some things that are possible, but they may not happen because people have a way of messing up everything. Third session, I'd like to review some of the things that have worked. What conditions would be required to make even more things work? And what could we do as individuals, as opinion makers? What's the responsible thing to do? A few years ago, I was asked to speak to the first Franciscan National Convention. They were trying to plan the 21st century work that they would do, and they asked me, as an amateur historian, to try to figure out what's unique about this place, North America, this time, the 1990s, so that they could use that as a basis for what they would do in the next century. I tried to imagine myself as a historian 1,000 years in the future, 2,990s, asking the question, what is unique about this time? We talk about the Bronze Age, the Iron Age. What would this age be? What would be unique about this culture? We think of religion when we think of the cultures of India. We think of philosophy with China. I came to the conclusion, in 1,000 years, there are two things historians will say about this time for sure, and maybe a third if we're lucky. The two will be, this was the time of science, the age of science, and North America was the epicenter. And number two, historians will say this was the first time that democracy was ever practiced by the majority of a group. I mean, we think back to Greece, and we think of that as the age of democracy. 15% of the people in Greece were able to participate. We think, but we have 225-year history in the United States. But when my mother was born in this country in this century, less than half the population could by law participate. Women could not participate. Minorities didn't. The poor didn't. We're in the first few decades where it's actually possible for the majority of people to participate in planning their future. The third thing that I would hope for would be that this was the time when we finally learned how to balance freedom and equality. The two are natural enemies. You give people freedom, and pretty soon 20% will own 80% of everything. You insist on equality, and you have to take away freedom. And so the history of the world has been an attempt to balance these things. And if we're lucky, we might get the best balance yet. But let's go back to the first thing, the age of science. What does science add? What are the ethical implications? At the time of Christ, science was much more developed than most of us realize. Astronomy was really a very forward-looking science at that time. Mathematics was very advanced. Medicine, surgery, even neurosurgery. People think of Columbus as the time when we realized the earth was round. It's not true. Scientists at the time of Christ knew the earth was round, and they were within 4 or 5% of knowing the circumference. But then something interesting happened. This great science heritage, Greek science, gradually disappeared in Europe. It moved through Syria, and we're fortunate that it moved, or it would have been gone forever. It moved through Syria to the Islamic world by about the 9th century, and 1,000 years ago, I can tell you that the best physicians in the world were Muslim. About 1150, translations started going back to Europe, and we saw a revival of the age of science. Leonardo of Pisa, the Polo family, Marco and his father, Niccolo, clocks, eyeglasses were discovered, compasses. Three standout scientists, Albert the Great, Abelard of Elbath, and Roger Bacon. A word about Roger Bacon. We're talking now about the 13th century. He was Oxford educated. He took his training in medicine and geriatrics. Now think of that, geriatrics, the 13th century. He entered a Franciscan order but did not actually become a priest. In 1265, Pope Clement IV asked him to summarize science. He worked feverishly, and after a year, he realized he wasn't going to get done, so he tried to do a summary of the summary. And when you look back at that, it is interesting what he wrote. It was so advanced. An aside here, at PLU at one point, I felt very pleased thinking I had discovered something new. And that is that the basis of all of science is chemistry and physics, and that the basis of chemistry and physics is mathematics. And I was just so pleased with this insight and gradually realized that everybody knew that. But then to read that Roger Bacon knew that in the 13th century, in his summary to the Pope, he talks about the basis of science is mathematics. He realized that the calendar was off a day every 125 years. He predicted airplanes, automobiles, submarines. He talked about optics and that it should be possible to make a telescope where you could see the enemy at a great distance. And his writing was actually used centuries later to build the first telescope. I mean, a marvelous man. And what is his conclusion? Science is awesome, but it is worthless if you don't have a moral compass. But then he went on to say, we don't have a moral compass, and he indicted the church leadership, the business leadership, that we lacked the moral compass to guide science. And keep that in mind over the next 3 days. What would Roger Bacon say today? 450 years ago, by 1543, there was just an outburst of science. We had Copernicus on the cosmos, Vesalius on anatomy, Archimedes in physics. And you'll remember Copernicus was not a formal scientist, but he came up with a theory that the planets were going around the sun, that everything was not going around the Earth. 20 years later, Galileo was born. Galileo started using a telescope about 1600, and as you well remember, he came up with the physics to show that Copernicus was right. I don't know that he was trying to argue with the church. Some people say he was doing this very deliberately. I don't think so. I think he honestly saw no problem between what he was coming up with and religious teaching. He wrote an article describing this, and he dedicated it to the Pope. I don't think he was trying to tweak anybody. I think he just was so happy to have discovered this and was writing it and dedicating it to the Pope. But you know the rest of the story. The church put him on trial. He was condemned and he recanted. And this may have been one of the most important events in what was seen then as a science-religious split, and totally unnecessary. Instead of being open to the truth, the church proclaimed what was true. And even Galileo, who knew better scientifically, backed down. And I think about our professor of ethics at Pacific Lutheran, Jesse Flieger, who used to say the greatest sin you can commit is against your own conscience. And that's what Galileo did. He backed down. Before science, one could argue on the basis of your interpretation and your powers of persuasion. And suddenly things were changed. There was a system now for proving things. The same year that Galileo died, Sir Isaac Newton was born. And Sir Isaac Newton was the person who actually put the physics and the proof to what Galileo and Copernicus had talked about. He was a passionate Protestant, and he never saw a problem between his science and his religion. So scientific methods provide a way to replicate, to show to others, to prove, to keep improving as people criticize and come up with a better approach to things. The answers change as the measurements improve. Who grades science? It's peer review. Because anytime you print something, people begin to criticize it, and they either have to come up with a better approach or it stands. And by convention, most scientific findings have to be repeated in order to become proven. Last night at the question and answer period, I made the statement that I am less sure of things as I get older. My wife says she hasn't noticed that, but it's true. And that we're always in the position of trying to make sufficient decisions with insufficient data. Let me give you three or four examples and then get back to looking at science. I said in science you repeat things in order to prove that they're right, and you don't go on the first publication of a scientific fact. That's usually true in public health sometimes. We don't have the luxury of proving it again. And I remember some years ago when toxic shock syndrome came on the scene, and some of you will recall, the first studies showed that there was a higher risk of toxic shock with the use of tampons. Then our second study came to the surprising conclusion that a certain tampon, Rely tampon, had the highest risk of all. And I can remember getting that information on a Friday and asking three different statistical groups to independently look at this over the weekend to see, is this right or not? Because with statistics, we're dealing with probabilities, not certainties. On Monday, they came back, and two of them said, it's absolutely right. The third said, it's absolutely wrong. That almost doesn't help. And yet, And yet you have to put the best judgment you can on the information. And so we decided to publish it. With that, Procter & Gamble withdrew Rely tampons from the market, and we can never check that again. So it's very difficult sometimes to make these decisions because these are million-dollar industries, and yet you always have to make the decision on the side of human health rather than on the side of money. A second case that was very troublesome about 15 years ago, I was given information that aspirin given to children who have flu or chickenpox could lead to a dangerous syndrome called Reye syndrome. Three different studies were done. None of them reached the point of what we call statistical significance. You can't hang your hat on this. And yet, if three of them were in that direction, it puts a real burden on you what to do. My decision was, parents should know as much as I do. And it may not be enough, but they should know as much as I do, and we decided to print it. I couldn't believe the wrath of the aspirin industry. They began calling me at home, calling me at my parents' home when we went to visit them, and a very subtle argument. You may be right or you may be wrong, but are you willing to risk the entire scientific reputation of CDC on being wrong, or would you rather wait and get more evidence? We decided we had to listen to the new evidence that they said they had, and it turned out not to be new evidence, so we set a date for publication. The Food and Drug Administration said they would publish this with us. It would be a joint statement. The night before it was to be published, the Food and Drug Administration called me at home to say the aspirin manufacturers had come in with new information, boxes of it, and it would take a period of time to analyze it. Therefore, they could not sign this statement. I worried about that most of the night. The aspirin manufacturers were so happy that once again they had delayed the publication. And so the next morning, without consulting my superiors, we published it. The aspirin manufacturers went to my boss, the Assistant Secretary for Health, a man by the name of Dr. Brandt, and he stood behind me. They went to the Secretary of Health and Human Services, Richard Schweiker, and he stood behind me. They went to the Reagan White House, and I was ordered to stop. And it was the day that I realized that I might not be in the right position anymore. But we now know that that was truth. There is a risk. Last night, the question came up about abortion. And it got me thinking afterwards about the terrible times I've gone through on this issue. And I'll just mention one incident because you see how easy theory is and how difficult it becomes when theory and practice come together and you have to make decisions. I was raised to think abortion was wrong, and I went through medical school thinking it was wrong, never was involved in an abortion. In Nigeria, a woman with eight children came to me and did not want a ninth child, and she was not pregnant. And as we went through the options of contraceptive, I'm not going to go through all that now, there was no option but an IUD, an intrauterine device. Our best understanding of that at the moment was that an IUD gives a monthly abortion. We're no longer sure about that, by the way, but at that time, people were sure. And I was faced with the question, do I insert an IUD or not? The nurse at our clinic in Nigeria said, if you do, you're on your own. I'm going outside the clinic and you can do what you want, but I'm not going to take part in this. The interesting thing to me is that I didn't hesitate for more than 30 seconds. I knew it was the right thing to do. But then I spent 2 years trying to figure out why I did that and learning what I could about abortion. And that's why I mentioned last night I held a seminar for ministers in the Atlanta area to try to figure out what is the difference between human tissue and human life. And looking at things, those of you that have ever worked in a lab know about HeLa cells. It's a perpetual cell chain taken from a woman, I think her name was Helen Lane, and that's why Hela is used. And every year, tons of that woman are produced in labs. And I ask myself, why does no one treat this as human life? These cells are just flushed down the toilet when we're done with them. No one looks on that as human life, but they certainly look on it as human tissue. And so the question of the theory versus the reality becomes very confusing. I found the same thing with death. At one time, it was very simple. You were dead when your heart stopped. And then with the first heart transplant, it was no longer certain who was dead. The person who gave the heart or the person who got the heart. And then the question went to brain death and the fact that if you get a flat brain wave, you are dead. What happens when we get brain transplants? And so the definitions keep changing. For me, I've reached my own understanding of what works as a definition for death. And for me, it's when people lose access to other human beings and the process is absolutely irreversible. It still requires judgment. But now I understand in my own mind how to make judgments on that. But let's go back to science. Science is the state of knowing. It's knowledge as distinguished from ignorance. Therefore, is not the dichotomy science versus ignorance rather than science versus religion? It's systemized knowledge. Religion is the service and worship of God, a set of beliefs and attitudes and practices. We start with the bias that we have to put the two fields together, or we talk about the interface. Maybe there isn't an interface at all. Maybe there's just truth. And there's different perspectives on how we see truth. So science is knowledge, systematic, the use of a scientific method. But Huxley put it best. He said, science is simply common sense at its best. And in a logical world, that would seem to be something to inform the service and worship of God. The scientific method is a procedure for a systematic pursuit of coming up with a hypothesis and testing it, coming up with an observation and testing it. It often starts with observations, as with Galileo and Darwin, or it starts with an idea, as with Einstein or Stephen Hawking or Murray Gell-Mann, and then it progresses to the hypothesis that has to be tested. Often the observation will give you the answer, how bears prepare their dens, or how bacteria behave, or how young find their mothers. But oftentimes, it's a statistical answer, and that's where we get into trouble. There's actually nothing very obscure about statistics, except the way we use them. If we're looking at a coin, the probability of heads is 0.5. And so when you see a study where it talks about the probability is 0.05, all that means is 5 times out of 100, you could have gotten that answer by chance alone. We talk about confidence limits, and all that tells us is how much confidence do we put in this? If we say the relative risk of someone getting lung cancer if they smoke is 6, we mean they have 6 times the chance of getting lung cancer as a non-smoker. And then we say the 95% confidence limits are 5.4 to 6.6. And all that means is we can have confidence 95% of the time that our answer will be within that range. It's not actually so complicated. What becomes complicated is we interpret what this means. For instance, you remember when we had the killing of young boys in Atlanta, serial killing. They finally found a man by the name of Wayne Williams, and with the first case, they found some fibers on the body of the child that were also in the car of Wayne Williams. They discovered that this was a very rare form of carpeting. And in fact, the chances of that fiber being in both the car and on this body was only one chance in a million that that could have happened by chance alone. All the rest of the time there would be a cause and effect. The lawyers, of course, jump on that. One chance in a million? Would you sentence a person when there's one chance in a million that they could be innocent? The second body was found the same fibers. Again, one chance in a million. And so the lawyer said, you're talking about one chance in 2 million? That's not right. It's 1 million times 1 million. It now becomes one chance in a trillion that you would actually find those fibers in his car and on both bodies. And yet people didn't understand. The point that I want to make is statistics are less certain than you might think, but they're far more certain than we need. They're less certain than you think they may be, but they're far more certain than we need. The methods used, I'll just mention two. One is to look forward, a prospective study, and one is to look backwards, a retrospective study. With prospective studies, in general, what you try to do, you have two groups of people who differ only in the attribute that you're trying to test. And if you have a good prospective study, you'll have one group that gets a new drug. I've been part of a prospective study for years where for a long time, every day I had to take a red tablet, the next day a white tablet. And it was a study to see two things. Will aspirin protect against heart attacks? Will certain vitamins protect against cancer? I didn't know for years whether I was taking aspirin or a placebo, vitamins or a placebo. And now the study has been finished. It's been found that the aspirin protects against heart disease and that I was getting the aspirin. The vitamins did not protect against cancer. It didn't matter. I wasn't getting them. And what you try to do with a study like this is to blind it. So the person getting this doesn't know if they're getting the drug or a placebo. And if you make it more refined, you double blind it. The person doing the study doesn't know what you're getting so that they can't influence in some unpredictable way. And if you really get refined, you have a double blind study with a crossover. Sometime during the study, people change what they're taking, but they don't know it, and the person giving it doesn't know it. And only the statisticians later can put it together. Sir Richard Dahl was the British scientist who first related lung cancer to tobacco. And he told me a story one day about how hard it is to do any of these studies. They seem simple in theory, they're difficult in practice. That they had a double-blind crossover study, and a woman came in indignant asking, why did you change my medication last week? And he said, we didn't change your medication. She was so certain of it that they took her out of the study and sent her to the person who was head of the study, and he was able to confirm they had switched her medication last week. But now he's very concerned. These groups are supposed to be so identical you can't tell the difference. What went wrong? How would she know that? Well, she said, I never actually take the tablets. She said, I throw them in the toilet, and last week for the first time they floated. So there are a lot of ways to get into trouble, even with science. Some of you will remember April 12, 1955, a press conference at the University of Michigan, and it was announced that the salt vaccine protected against polio. I mean, that was such a memorable day. That was a prospective, double-blind study. A million children. Half got this new salt vaccine, half got a placebo. They simply got an injection of water. And then they were followed to see who would get polio. That is a prospective scientific study. Now, an interesting thing about this, when I went to school, I thought there were just two groups, those that got the drug, those that got the placebo, and you compared them. What I didn't understand, really, until Tom Droege of Velpo explained this years ago, was that you have one group with a medication plus faith against another group, faith alone, but you don't compare either of these groups against nothing. We haven't come up with a good way of comparing an intervention with no intervention. We only know how to use an intervention plus faith against faith alone. Retrospective studies, just a word on that. This takes something and goes back and tries to figure out what was different with this group versus the other. When you see how obvious it is that tobacco causes ill health, don't you wonder why it took so long to discover that? I mean, it is such a significant factor in ill health. I'll tell you why it was so hard. The first studies were retrospective studies using patients in hospitals that had lung cancer. They were compared against patients in the hospital that did not have lung cancer, and no one understood at that time the impact of tobacco on hospitalization in general. So a lot of these people were in the hospital because of tobacco, but they didn't have lung cancer. They had heart disease, they had pancreatic cancer, they had other things. And so now you were comparing smoking rates in the two, and they weren't that different. That was a time when 55% of people were smoking in this country. So it becomes very difficult sometimes in retrospective studies to get accurate interpretation. What would you need with lung cancer? Back to some things are less certain than you think, more certain than we need. If you really wanted the final proof, and the tobacco industry keeps saying this, it lacks the final science. If you really wanted the final proof, you would take thousands of children and force them to smoke. Thousands of children who would never be allowed to smoke. They'd be raised in the same environment. You see, it's logistically impossible. It's ethically impossible. Some things are not worth doing well. Less certain than you may think, more certain than we need. Some lessons in science for me. They don't have to be for you. Number one, even the best science requires judgment. Science without wisdom is absolutely dangerous. Lesson number two, science continues to build on the past. It was Sir Isaac Newton who was credited with saying, "If I see farther than those who preceded me, it's because I stand on the shoulders of those giants who preceded me." By saying this, he proved his point, because we now know that that was plagiarized. Newton took this from a clergyman, Robert Burton, who wrote a book called The Anatomy of Melancholy. Robert Burton, in turn, footnotes that to show that he is quoting Lucan 1,600 years before. There's an entire book, by the way, tracing the history of this saying. In Lucan, when you read it, you see that the person saying it is, in effect, saying the ancients may have been right. If we see farther, it's because we stand on the shoulders of the giants that preceded us. At any rate, we do build on those who came before. But the interesting thing with science is we build on the best. That is, we don't have to rediscover how to make a car. We don't have to rediscover, each one of us, how to do a light bulb, or to develop a computer, or to discover penicillin, or to make x-rays. We keep building on the very best. It's an interesting concept that we all benefit from the very best, not from the average. Lesson number three, the dichotomy is not science versus religion, it's truth versus untruth. So why was the church so arrogant? I think it was because the church was so powerful. The church was so powerful against states that it didn't for a moment think it could not control science. You look back at Thomas Becket and Henry II, and you remember the story how Becket was a very happy archdeacon of Canterbury, but when he became archbishop, he changed and he became a man of God. And what happens? He runs up against Henry II. He has to leave the country, and the Pope tells Henry II, you better take him back. The church was more powerful than the state. Becket goes back, and on December 30th, 1170, he's murdered by four knights, and they killed him apparently without any knowledge on the part of Henry. But the world rose up against Henry, and by the time this is over, he's going barefoot, he's being whipped by monks, he dies a broken person. The church won. The church was more powerful. The same thing happened with Pope Innocent III and John, where they get into a power struggle, and John says that he is going to banish every Catholic clergyman. So the Pope says that he's going to excommunicate John. John says, I'm going to take the property of all the church buildings and church people. And the Pope says, to anyone that wants, the church, the king's property will belong to you if you simply take it. And John realizes he's beaten, and he goes back to the Pope and says, let's make a deal. And you remember what he did. He gave all of England to the Pope for 5 days. And then the Pope gives it back to him, and he becomes the vassal of the Pope. And he thinks he's now settled everything, but he hasn't, and before you know it, people are coming to him demanding things, and that's how the Magna Carta was signed. It defined the rights of the nobles and the clergy rather than the whole population, but the church won. It's different with science because science was not after power, it was after truth, a different form of power. Lesson number 4, when you get finished with the history of science, the methods, the interpretation, the statistics, there's one lesson. Stephen Hawking points it out in his book, A Short History of Time. He says the history of science is the gradual realization that things do not happen in an arbitrary fashion, that it is a cause and effect world, and that our job is to try to understand what those causes are and what the effects are. It is not a fatalistic world. Two stories from college. I had a teacher by the name of William Strunk for biology at PLU. Those of you who knew him know that he was a formidable person. I mean absolutely formidable. He used to walk into the room lecturing, and he would walk to the blackboard and write with both hands. I've never seen anyone else that could do that. He could be writing phyla with one hand, classes and families with another hand, and he was very demanding. There was a soft spot that you didn't always detect. I remember once when I was a laboratory assistant, and he said to the class, I have 75 questions around the room, and you would rotate around and look at a question or a specimen, and then you would write down the answer. He said, you will have 30 seconds at each station, and if you've done your studying, this is going to be ample time. And he said, I'm going to leave Bill Fagey here with a stopwatch, and he will ring the bell each time you're to shift stations. Then he whispers to me, you better give him a minute and a half, they're going to need it. And so when I took my first biology class, and he talked about evolution, and this was so different than what I had been taught up until that point, that I was confused And as formidable as he was, I went to see him. And his question was, would you lose your faith if you found out evolution was correct? Is your faith so weak that one scientific fact would change it? And then he started asking me some questions. He said, okay, you believe the Genesis story. How old was Adam when he was created? And I said, I don't know. He said, I don't want to know exactly. He said, I want to know, was he a 20-year-old? Was he a 50-year-old? Was he a 4-year-old? Well, he wasn't a 4-year-old. Okay, so he was a man. Yeah, he was a man. The day after he was created, he said, would you have recognized him as a man? And I said, I think so. He said, what if someone else had said, oh, you're only one day old? Would they have been right? Well, yes. But he said, see, there's a perspective on truth. He said, what if he had been created with a past? He said, how many chromosomes do you think he had? Now, I'll show you how long ago this was. At that time, people thought we had 48 chromosomes. So I said 48, which was the right answer. The real answer is 46, by the way. And he said, okay, where did he get them? So he must have had theoretical parents and theoretical grandparents and theoretical great-grandparents. So he said, if Adam could have been born with a past, couldn't this Coalfield have been born with a past, created with a past? And so wouldn't it be possible for someone to believe creation in 7 days and someone else see this as a process of millions of years, and they're both right? So it was that kind of thing that became very important. Don't be afraid of the truth. Susan, last night, don't be afraid of the whole truth. Be slow to judgment. Don't insist that others have to believe as you do. Perspective can be different and it can be valid. The other story from PLU days, the basis of science, as I mentioned before, is chemistry and physics. And that gets down finally to atoms. I like to tell medical students, you know, you're made up of the waste products of history. Every atom in you has been other places. You've got atoms that were in popes and in pine trees and in pigs, but they've all come together to form you in a different way, but you are the product of history. And if the basis of that is mathematics, then we come to a very interesting point, that you develop a mathematical formula or theory, and then you prove it. That causes you to develop a mathematical formula at a lower level. You get to a point where it's all based on a mathematical formula that you can't prove, which means the basis of science is faith. Faith is the basis of both science and religion. Lesson number 5. Science is ahead of everything. It's ahead of our ethics, it's ahead of our theology, it's ahead of our sociology, it's ahead of our understanding. We knew how to test for the AIDS virus, but didn't know when to use that test. We can test things in parts per billion, and we don't even know what it means. We have exquisite healthcare abilities, and we don't know how to distribute those abilities. Science has become so powerful that it's becoming dangerous. And I can tell you that there is nothing that we can do to slow that down. And therefore, if there's a gap between science and everything else, we should not be thinking in terms of how do we slow down science, because we won't. It's how do we close that gap? How do we speed up our understanding of ethics and theology and sociology? The ethics panel was formed only after DALI was announced. Why wasn't this formed beforehand? Why weren't people anticipating what was about to happen? And I can tell you, whatever you think about cloning, there's some rich person, some rich egotist, someplace in the world right now trying to figure out how to do that. And it won't matter what we think. Lesson number 6, we easily lose perspective. I like to tell the story of Anne Morrow Lindbergh when she was 8 years old and her mother invited J.P. Morgan for tea. And so Anne's mother took her aside ahead of time and said, when we look at people, we look at whole people. We don't just look at how tall or short or fat or thin or how big their ears are. She never mentioned nose. We look at the whole person. And she got the point across. J.P. Morgan came. She introduced Anne. Anne sat there quietly, obviously intrigued and didn't say anything. And finally, she said she wanted to go outside and play. And her mother breathed a sigh of relief as she left the room and said, now, Mr. Morgan, would you like one or two lumps of sugar in your nose? It's human nature that we dwell on certain things, that we have trouble seeing the broad picture. But I can tell you, we're smack in the middle of science. Whether you know it or not, from the cars you drive to the clothes you're wearing to the radio you listen to, the television you watch, the computers that map out your life, the pills that you're taking, the safety of the water we're drinking here, you can't imagine your dependence on science. Years ago, I was giving a measles clinic in Nigeria. Children were going by. I was using a jet injector. We could actually vaccinate 1,000 people an hour with a jet injector. And I was thinking to myself, what a wonder of science this was. And then I started thinking, what does it actually take to get a dose of measles vaccine to a child in Nigeria? And I'm not going to go through the whole story, but you can imagine what it takes to have research labs that develop a vaccine, a grant system from the federal government that gets money through the NIH to universities around this country to make that possible, the drug companies that produce the vaccine, everything that that requires, needles and syringes and vials and cardboard boxes, and it has to come by air, or you wouldn't be doing this in Nigeria. And so you think of Boeing and the research into airplanes, and it gets there and it now goes by Land Rover, and you think of what this requires and all the health educators and the vaccinators. And when you get this whole string of people that have been involved, and then you imagine the kind of school system that's been required to educate all of them, it's very easy to see that it took millions of people for that one dose of vaccine to get to a child, and nothing could go wrong. I mean, this is just miraculous. Millions of people. We were living in Africa when I first heard that phrase, it takes a whole village to raise a child, and I don't like that phrase. It takes the whole world to raise a child. That is so provincial. Before Mrs. Clinton put out her book, I even wrote her and told her it would be a mistake if she called it that. And you see the power that I have. And the point is that science has increased our dependence and our interdependence, which is something we'll talk about tomorrow. Lesson number 7. I repeat from last night the question of medical ethics. It's a real subject, a needed subject, a powerful subject, and I think largely misdirected. As I said last night, medical ethicists spend their time on the beginning of life and the end of life, and they miss the fact that the major medical ethical battlefield of our day revolves around budgets, how we spend our resources, where we put our money. We spend over $3 billion a day on the healthcare system, less than 1% of that on prevention. When you do surveys of Americans to find out what is it you fear, the second most feared thing on the list turns out to be cancer, second only to public speaking. We know how to absolutely prevent 1/3 to 1/2 of all cancers, and that's not where we put our money. Ethicists don't enter that arena, and budget makers don't see themselves as ethicists. How do we get that changed? Ethicists could be forcing a lot of questions. Before the healthcare reform, I had a chance to talk to Mrs. Clinton, not knowing she was going to be taking this over. And I told her one of the biggest traps will be people will want to center the debate on access, quality, and cost. And I said, if you allow that to happen, you will be looking back in a couple of years asking, what happened? Why didn't this work? I said, the question to ask is, how do we get health outcomes, not access? Health outcomes should be the thing that rules our conversation. There was almost no discussion at all about health outcomes. Lesson number 6, science does impact on ethics. It's easy to say science is neutral, and I hear that over and over. Science is neutral, it does not change the ethics. But the questions are different. If you're looking at the implication of the first stone axe versus nuclear weapons, where one person can change the entire future of the world. Dr. Hall mentioned last night the mystery of the combination of good and evil, and I found myself thinking about smallpox. Smallpox eradication was seen as nothing but good. Next month, it'll be 20 years since the last case of smallpox any place in the world. So many millions of people have been kept from getting smallpox, but smallpox vaccine itself killed people. There was a downside. No one wanted to even pretend that it was there. Now you'll hear we've gone 6 years without a case of polio in this hemisphere. It's not true. We've gone 6 years without a case of wild polio. People still get polio from vaccine, and no one wants to count that. There is a downside. He's right, evil doesn't have the last word, but neither does good. And we have to look at this downside of science. It's not just weapons, it's acid rain, it's global warming, it's many things. Finally, number 9, Roger Bacon was right. We still need a moral, ethical compass. And this is true whether we're talking about nuclear energy, or whether we're talking about cloning, or whether we're talking about the distribution of health care. Health may not be a right, but certainly some equity in access to our health care delivery abilities marks an ethical society. And why do we have so much more difficulty with this than the Canadians do? Or even using antibiotics. Fred last night used the phrase bowing down to the free market. We have antibiotic resistance because of the free market. The free market puts out antibiotics, they get misused, and we get resistance. And we've not figured out how to balance the social needs and the market needs. That shouldn't be that hard. We should be able to find a way that companies can make a profit and the drug is used responsibly. And so we gather over these 3 days not to look at two subjects, science and religion, but two perspectives on truth, and to ask, how can we live responsibly in such a confusing world? I'll leave with two quotes. One from Einstein that you've heard many times: science without religion is lame. Religion without science is blind. And the other from Churchill. He said, "History will be good to me. I know because I intend to write it." You are writing history, and what you write will determine how good history is to others. Thank you.